before California considers the level of dangerous. But we should be clear, the European Union has banned 1,3-D and chloropicrin. In fact, all the pesticides studied in the UCLA report, as well as 6 of the 8 that are most used pesticides near Ohlone Elementary. So what did the state find in the air monitoring testing? Well, in its first full year of testing in 2012, the level was 14% above the cancer risk level at elementary school. And over the last 3 years, the average has been 93% of the state's cancer risk level. So it's just under the state regulatory goal. But if that's not enough to say enough already with allowing our children to breathe this poisoned air, the UCLA study tells us that the state's just under the risk level figure is most surely understated, because it doesn't take into account the presence of other fumigants, which combine with 1,3-D to magnify cancer risk. And indeed, chloropicrin does that, and indeed, chloropicrin is applied in huge amounts at Ohlone Elementary School. So the DPR is right now drafting a statewide policy about regulations for pesticides used near schools. And so they must consider this information about the combined effects of pesticides in making that policy. And if they can't ban, if they don't ban this stuff like they have in Europe, you know, the least they can do is push this stuff as far away from children, at school children, as possible. A mile, at least, is what we've been calling for.
All right. And Mark Willa, let me ask you, we know that there's a lot of corporate money, a lot of lobbying money. The major corporations have a lot to say about whether these kids are going to continue to be poisoned. Could you talk about that part of the struggle?
Well, look, 1,3-D is manufactured by Dow, Dow AgroSciences. This is that toxic air fumigant that causes cancer. And the state was so worried about it that it was banned in California between 1990 and 1995. It was brought back by hard lobbying and successful lobbying, extremely successful lobbying by Dow, because it's now one of the most used pesticides in the state. Yeah, these are big factors, big forces to deal with. And, you know, we have to get our state, it's been captured by these companies. And so we need to take it back and say, you got to put the health of people, of children, ahead of Dow's profits.
Dr. Lopez, I'd love to hear more from you about what happens among the families that you work with when they find out about this, when they know about this. Is there a sense of a growing resistance? We know that it's not easy to complain, particularly if you happen to be undocumented. You may be being poisoned, but if you speak up, you may end up being poisoned and then getting deported.
Right. That's absolutely correct. And 83% of farm workers in Santa Cruz County are undocumented, 75% statewide. So they tend not to say anything, and it's very depressing. I actually told one Oaxacan family that has children that go to Ohlone, I told them, I said, keep them home. If I were that parent, I wouldn't allow them to go to school and be subjected to this. And I think there needs to be a groundswell statewide of protest at the state level, insisting that the DPR does its job. It has a mandate to regulate pesticides. It's not doing its job. Why are we paying their salaries with our tax dollars? I think this is disgraceful. And in Santa Cruz County, the South County is mostly brown, and many, many farm workers. The North County is mostly Anglo or white. And in the North County, we have these laws about crab fishing so that white people don't eat crab with neurotoxins. But it's perfectly okay to spray brown children with these awful neurotoxic chemicals. And I think this kind of environmental racism, it's a civil rights issue, Dennis. I mean, this is absolutely intolerable and unconscionable.
All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking about a new report that talks about the dangers of pesticides that continue to be sprayed near schools where mostly black and brown kids. This, we're talking about a large community of undocumented workers who have to think twice about how to defend their children, because they do have all kinds of challenges in terms of deportation and what's going on at that level of racism. And then, of course, there's the protecting of the children. And so, Mark, what comes next on this battle? Where do you see this going? And how will you try and call more awareness to what's going on?
Yeah, I think what's next in the battle is pushing and pushing and pushing on the state regulators to make as strong a policy as we can get them to make. Regarding pesticide use around schools. We really have this important historic moment. There's never been anything like this. The Department of Pesticide Regulation has never done a statewide policy that could be so far reaching as one to address all the schools in the state to make them more protective. And that would be a big step forward. They are drafting their policy right now. It's delayed. You know, of course, our concern is they may be listening to, you know, other forces that we discussed earlier, like Dow. So we have to keep the pressure on now with news conferences, with meetings with, community leaders and elected leaders.
Any teachers speaking out? Teachers in there? Teachers? Any teachers speaking out?
They're absolutely speaking out. Yeah, they're at the forefront of this because they're concerned about their students.
And themselves, not to mention, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, today at our news conference, we had two teachers from the mighty Pajaro Valley Federation of Teachers, the president of that union, Francisco Rodriguez, and the vice president, Sarah Henney. And, they gave powerful speeches and powerful concerns. I even have some quotes. Sarah said that, we're tired of the children that we teach and care for being the guinea pigs of the pesticide industry. We're tired of the inaction of the state and local pesticide regulators to protect us from these health threats. If we're not going to ban these hazardous threats from fumigants yet, then the least we can do is push them far away from the most vulnerable. We need 1 mile no-spray buffer zones around our schools.
That's right.
Francisco echoed that, too.
And what was that teacher's name?
Sarah Henney.
Sarah Henney.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Well, we will continue to stay in touch with you, Dr. Lopez. Mark Weller, incredibly important story. Really, we follow it from Flint to down south in California, where poor people and children are continuing to be poisoned. And it being pushed forward by corporations who are just squeezing people dry and leaving them by the wayside. We're going to say more about this as this unfolds. Thanks both for being with us on Flashpoints. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dennis.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Coming up next, we have an amazing new documentary. The documentary, well, it's a six-part expanded series called Capitalism, Episode 1, Adam Smith, The Birth of the Free Market, Episode 2, The Wealth of Nations, A New Gospel, Episode 3, well, it goes on and on. You know what? We're going to play Episode 4 for you, which is called What If Marx... That's not Groucho. What if Marx was right?
We were told that capitalism is the product of big thinkers and big ideas. But is it true? How did ideas shape our lives? What is their relation to reality? Can they help us understand today's economic crisis, let alone the future of capitalism?
Hey!
Dawn in Nanjing, China's last surviving communist commune. On the surface, a time warp, complete with revolutionary posters and radio news piped into the main square. But the community claims it rediscovered Marx's values as a defense against China's roaring capitalism. London's financial center. Marx is unexpectedly being rediscovered here as well.
And all Marx and Engels' warning over the dangers of monopoly capitalism and concentrated finance have come to pass.
And we thought he was gone forever.
With the collapse of the Soviet Union and the fall of communism, that system of government was consigned to the dustbin of history, and Marx was thrown out along with it.
So is it possible that we misread Marx? Is it possible that his insight into 19th century capitalism has more relevance now than in past decades? Karl Marx House in Trier, Germany, besieged by Chinese tourists.
Karl Marx was born in 1818 in the Rhineland, which is the westernmost province of Prussia. It was an interesting part of Greater Germany because it had been occupied by Napoleon. And so it had been initiated in the ideas of the French Enlightenment. And that was the milieu in which he was raised.
I can feel no regret, wrote a young woman to her loved one. I shut my eyes very tightly. Once again, I lay close to your heart, drunk with love and joy. A romantic love letter, like so many others. The innocence of the early 19th century in a provincial German town. The only difference is that the man the letter was addressed to was Karl Marx.
In Trier, he met Jenny von Westphalen. She was quite a catch for Marx because he was the son of a Jewish lawyer and was by such a social outcast. She was the daughter of a Prussian baron.
So he got educated in Trier and then he went to Berlin. I guess the expectation was that he'd go to college and be a good boy and learn law or something like that. He was politically very much engaged because there was always this kind of question of after the French Revolution, would there be sort of liberal democracy? What was going to happen to the autocratic regimes in Germany and so on? So he was kind of mixed up in all of that.
More than a century later, the romantic student from Trier had been transformed into the menace of Western governments and capitalist countries.
Captain Capitalism!
Ah, making out the old Christmas list, I see. Let's see here. World peace, an end to world hunger, free health care. This isn't a Christmas list, son. Who the hell taught you this, child?
Santa did.
Marx had become a boogeyman, the conspirator behind every social demand.
That red suit gives you away, Carl.
Captain Capitalism! So, you discovered my plan. Santa Claus is truly I, Karl Marx, the undead founder of communism.
The reason for this radical transformation from a promising young student into a dangerous revolutionary can be found in the basement of the Trier Museum, kept in a safe. In that year, Europe erupted in popular revolts. It was the moment Marx had been waiting for after years of agitating for radical political reforms. A specter is haunting Europe, opens the Communist Manifesto. The specter of communism. All the powers of Europe have entered into holy alliance to exorcise this specter.
Unfortunately for Marx, he was always late in all of his writing, and he didn't publish the Communist Manifesto until after the 1848 revolts had begun. So he couldn't take credit for those. But in fact, The Communist Manifesto was sort of lost in the revolution and was only rediscovered later.
The story behind the Communist Manifesto did not begin in the 1848 revolution, but in Paris, 5 years earlier, when Marx met Friedrich Engels, the revolutionary son of a wealthy industrialist.
They met at a Paris cafe that was known worldwide as being a place where chess masters matched wits. Marx and Engels spent 10 days and 10 nights talking, and at the end of that time, they came out feeling that they were completely in agreement in all things. And the beautiful relationship was born.
Marx meeting Engels was, I think, a crucial moment. He met somebody who was actually engaged in working in the factories of Manchester and therefore could talk to Marx about the labor process.
They are worse slaves than the Negroes in America, wrote Engels, for they are more sharply watched. And yet it is demanded of them that they shall live like human beings, shall think and feel like men. This they can do only under glowing hatred towards their oppressors, which degrades them as machines.
Marx went to Manchester with Engels for a little trip in 1845. He saw the people who were living in the most degraded conditions, who were building this industrial future by working in the factories. He saw the families that had been torn apart by the factory work, the mothers who had to give their infants opium in the morning so that they could go off to work and assume that the children were going to be drugged all day and they wouldn't have to be cared for. For a man like Marx, a social and political theorist and an economic theorist, to go there would be to walk right in the laboratory of humanity, of industrial humanity.
While in 1848 the Communist Manifesto was ignored, in 1917, it was the blueprint for the Bolshevik Revolution and its global ambition.
Ever hear of Karl Marx? In his mind, communism was born more than 100 years ago.
Marx has now been transformed into a global threat.
This is the Kremlin, citadel of Russian communism. Looking closer, we see a public display of giant portraits of communist leaders. Here was a new face. But in the background was an old one, Karl Marx.
The Marx that people in the 20th century and the 21st century ran away from was Marx of the Communist Manifesto. That's the person that I think capitalist governments and democracies and Western governments held up as the person who was responsible for communism and its atrocities in the 20th century.
So maybe we got it all wrong. We focused so much on the revolutionary message of the Communist Manifesto and ignored the bulk of the document, which analyzed the real revolution that Marx wrote about, capitalism.
Ladies and gentlemen, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels were the first to chart the uncompromising, unrelenting, compulsively iconoclastic nature of capitalism. It has pitilessly torn asunder the motley feudal ties that bound man to his natural superiors, and has left remaining no other nexus between man and man than naked self-interests, than callous cash payments. And it was Marx who revealed how capitalism would crush languages, cultures, traditions, even nations in its wake. In one word, it creates a world after its own image, he wrote. I would like to suggest to you that Marx has rarely seemed more relevant. Marx's stock resurges on a 150-year tip was how the New York Times, marked the 150th anniversary of the publication of the Communist Manifesto. A text which more than any other, as they put it, recognized the unstoppable wealth-creating power of capitalism, predicted it would conquer the world, and warned that this inevitable globalization of national economies and cultures would have divisive and painful consequences.
After the publication of the Communist Manifesto, Marx was expelled from continental Europe. He was once again a refugee, this time arriving in London in 1849.
Imagine Dean Street in 1850, the year Karl Marx and his family moved into this Soho neighborhood. The streets were teeming with refugees, people who had fled failed revolts on the continent. They arrived in this country, some with only the clothes on their backs, many not even speaking the language. Marx and his family were among the lucky, but all they had, three adults and three children, were two rooms and an attic. And in those cramped quarters, Marx tried to make sense of what he had just experienced and what he saw on the streets around him.
And next door, a brand new exhibition opened right at the time Marx began writing Das Kapital, an exhibition celebrating the achievements of the Industrial Revolution.
It was a triumph of industry. Man's greatest achievements were on display. And so this was the dawn of a new era. King capitalism was on the throne. And yet Marx up in his garret was busily scribbling why the system would never work. Yes, it produced wonders, but it would also produce great destruction.
I teach Marx, and the question I always ask is, what can we learn from Marx? And what do we have to do for ourselves? And I think that's a very important question to ask, because very frequently in the past, people have read their Marx and then sort of, I don't know, plugged reality into it and then said, ah, here's the answer. I don't think you can do that. I think there's only a limited set of things we can learn from Marx. Paradoxically, we can't really learn that much about socialism or communism or the future from Marx. We can learn a great deal about how capital works.
The wealth of societies in which capital modes of production prevail presents itself as an immense accumulation of commodities. Our investigation must therefore begin with the analysis of a commodity. Karl Marx, Das Kapital, Volume 1.
Tom? Tom, what do you want for breakfast?
What'd you say?
What do you want for breakfast?
I don't care.
A commodity is, in the first place, an object outside of us. A thing that by its properties satisfies human wants. Das Kapital.
Oh, well.
While she gets Tom's breakfast, let's take a closer look at that pan. The iron ore for that pan came from the Mesabi Range. So let's start there and see what happened. Maybe it'll give us an idea of just what it is we have.
Now, what Marx does in Volume 1 of Capital is have a little section called The Fetishism of Commodities. And what it basically means is that our daily experience doesn't actually tell us or give us all the information we need to understand how a system is working. Our daily experience is we take some money and we buy a commodity and we take it home. That's our daily experience. But that doesn't tell you anything about the labor that went into the commodity. It doesn't tell you anything about why it is that this commodity costs twice as much as that commodity. And Marx is kind of saying the market system disguises all of those social relations.
There are many different commodities with different use values, but they have only one common property left. That of labor itself, Das Kapital.
The Industrial Revolution, which we conventionally date from around 1780, was founded upon the creation of a factory system with large-scale machinery and, of course, a labor process that was very different from that which artisans making their, you know, cabinets or so on engaged in. This conversion and this rise of industrial capitalism from 1780 onwards was, in Marx's view, a crucial transformation.
The worker is related to the product of labor as to an alien object. The more the worker spends himself, the more powerful becomes the alien world of objects which he creates. The poorer he himself, his inner world, becomes. Karl Marx.
This iPad worker, who asked for his identity to be hidden, has been given a camera to film his life outside the factory. Once, these workers were peasants, with a connection to the land and its products. Now they're part of an assembly line. Alienation, argued Marx, is built into the manufacturing process of commodities.
To Marx, it's the idea of living labor, which is so crucial, which distinguishes him very much from the classical political economists who saw labor as a fact of production. They call it a factor of production. It's a thing which gets put into production and then produces something. For Marx, it's not. It's a process.
I used to teach introductory geography class, and the first lesson I would say, can you tell me where your breakfast came from today?
Come on, Bernie. Time for breakfast. Tony Tiger
said. People would say, well, you know, I went to the cafeteria. And I say, okay, well, where did it come from? Well, I went to the supermarket. Oh, where did it come from? Where did it come from? Where did it come from? After a little while, I get them to go back and start to think about the person cutting sugar cane in the Dominican Republic, and that sugar gets on your breakfast table, and you have a relationship with that person who is cutting the sugar cane. But the market doesn't tell you anything about that. It disguises all of that.
A lush countryside in India hides what Marx saw as another characteristic of market's expansion. The transformation more and more of life into commodities. This group of cotton growers banded together to fight the invasion of their fields by genetically modified seeds.
Seed in India has been recognized as the source of life. And the very word bija, ja is life. Every ritual is about keeping seed forever.
Those seeds have now been genetically engineered and made into a commodity which farmers are encouraged to buy annually with the promise of higher yield.
Biotechnology, answering the world's call for a better future, today.
For some of these women, the new promise of the commodity of seeds turned into a nightmare. Genetically engineered seeds, which needed to be purchased every year, pushed their husbands into debt.
So they always borrow. They get the seed on credit. Now, the creditors take collateral in terms of the land mortgage. So 2 years later, when a farmer cannot pay back, the new money lender, who is the agent of the seed and chemical companies, comes and says, your land is today mine. They don't tell their wives the seed has got us into debt. So when they get into debt, they're ashamed. When they know they're losing their land, they're shocked, because the bond with the land is still vital for a peasant culture. That's the day a farmer will drink pesticide to end their lives. And the figure has now hit 260,000 suicides. It is the greed of capital accumulation that has turned seed into something that has to be bought every year, that has been turned into a commodity, a consumer product. And the combination of new sources of profit for corporations.
I think that the idea of life as a commodity, really, it's interesting, because is a cow a commodity or a pig? I would say they've been commodities for a very long time, and we don't really care about that. So where do we draw the line? And the line may be in human beings. I think what we really worry about is human beings.
And we as a society might have already crossed this line.
Her announcement made headlines around the world. Angelina Jolie underwent a double mastectomy after a genetic test showed she had a mutated BRCA1 gene, giving her an 87% chance of getting breast cancer. Her news put this company, Myriad Genetics, front and center. It has patents on the BRCA1 and 2 genes.
Once life is transformed into a commodity, it is subject to market laws. Investments in genes like those in seeds need to be protected by patent, keeping competition away.
In the system we have in this country, and the investment system we have, which many people do think are the reason why we have been the leader for so long in so many areas, that's just the way it works.
So the production of commodities, according to Marx, not only transforms life, it changes our perceptions of nature and of ourselves.
Marx's theory of social change, again, is a process. A process that says ideas have to change, but if the production process doesn't change, then the ideas don't mean anything. The production process can change, but if the ideas don't change, it doesn't mean anything. So we have to, it's the relationship between the production process and the ideas and the social relations and the institutional arrangements, and daily life has to change.
The World Congress on Industrial Biotechnology and Bioprocessing, the world's largest industrial biotechnology event.
The fetish of commodities, according to Marx, masks their role in impacting social change. Barely 60 years ago, scientific innovations were rarely patented and never industrialized in such a way.
1955, a year of anxiety and triumphs. A major medical hurdle was crossed with the discovery by Dr. Jonas Salk of the anti-polio vaccine, which was to spread...
60 years ago, no one talked about patenting the polio vaccine or selling it for a fee.
Who owns the patent on this vaccine?
Well, the people, I would say. There is no patent. This is... Could you patent the sun?
I mean, I can think back to a time when we had ideas, crazy ideas now, about social solidarities. We're all individuals now, you know, and that's what neoliberalism changed.
The 60s caught capitalism completely off guard. How are companies to sell products to a generation that had rejected consumerism? The answer was to tune into the movement and to sell to the individual in everyone. The strategy worked. The marketing machine captured the spirit of 60s individualism and made it its own.
So Marx has what I call a co-evolutionary theory of social change. And to the degree that capital is a permanently revolutionary configuration, so we would see movements in ideas, movements in social relations.
Leaving ideology behind, we now derive a sense of personal identity and empowerment from the goods we purchase and consume. Go on, break the rules, define who you are. With our sneakers.
By the time you get towards the end of Capital, Marx does something interesting. He comes back to the idea of fetishism. And the big fetish is, of course, the money form and the credit system.
Do you have money jitters? Ask the obliging Bank of America for a jar of soothing instant money, M-O-N-E-Y, in the form of a convenient personal loan. Available now at Bank of America.
In order to expand tomorrow's demand and increase profits, today's production needs to be financed.
That means the credit system has to come in here. And what you can derive from this immediately is that the accumulation of capital in the history has always been paralleled by an accumulation of debt. You cannot have one without the other.
A large portion of this money, capital, is always necessarily purely fictitious. That is, title value. Just as paper. Karl Marx, Das Kapital.
One of the things that Marx did, I think, very neatly, was to demonstrate fundamental and foundational underlying relations.
And that underlying relation between the accumulation of debt and the accumulation of capital can be looked at in a number of very specific ways. I'll give you one example. Tract housing is being built. Where do the builders get the money to do it? They borrow money from a financial institution and say, give me the money and I will buy the land and I will build the housing. Okay? And then there'll be a rate of return on that and I'll pay you back. Now, in order for that to happen, they have to be able to sell the housing to somebody. Buyers out there, they go to the same financial institution and say, lend me some money to buy the house that you have financed the production of. This is fictitious capital at work, because the financial institution that has surplus money is actually funding both the production and the consumption of the housing. Right now, we are in a crisis where fictitious capital is all over the place. But what Marx does is this brilliant thing of saying, there's a surface appearance which is the fetish, I'm going to go behind it and actually be able to describe to you the nature of this fetish, which creates this thing called fictitious capital.
Adrian Sobaru could be described as a victim of fictitious capital, a victim of debt which was never his. His story begins here in the Romanian parliament on December 23rd, 2011.
Romania's parliament canceled a no-confidence vote on Thursday after a Romanian electrician staged a one-man protest.
Et là, il y a eu des bruits un peu bizarres à la télé parce que même les...
On his T-shirt, he wrote, "You have gunned us down. You have killed our children's future. You can take away our money and our lives, but not our freedom." From this tiny apartment in Bucharest, Adrian Sobaru and his wife raised two kids on his small salary of a public TV technician. After 2011, his salary was cut by 25%, and so was the financial help for a special education for Callan, their autistic son. How and why did the debt of his country lead to Adrian Sobaru's desperate act?
That was shocking to all Romanians, I presume. But because this is my way of thinking, I framed that episode, tragic episode, into a much wider frame. For many years, I thought about the way the financial industry has gone, or the derailed high finance and what was not going well. We realized that a growth model based on free movement of capital, total financial liberalization, and overborrowing by the private sector create fragility and create a vulnerability for the economy as a whole that may be very, very painful when a crisis occurs.
In Romania, foreign capital in search of return flooded Romanian banks, which fueled growth based on debt.
The bankers step in and they helped the consumer growing, and money were flooding into the country. A lot of foreign savings flooding into Romania via banking channels, and they reached the Romanian consumers, and everybody could afford buying new things like cars and houses. And then the people thought that, we have reached the market economy and we can afford more. But actually, there were too much expectation and maybe some false expectations.
Romania now the latest European country wrestling with violent protests over budget cuts and financial issues.
The bubble finally burst here, as everywhere. Debt, as Marx foresaw, is a form of fictitious capital. As a public employee, Adrian was never part of the boom. But when the bubble burst, the state turned against its weakest citizens.
Capital is perpetually moving its crisis tendencies around. If you look at the most recent crisis, it started in the housing market.
If deputies Alan Mathias and Derek Steverson come to your door, your house no longer belongs to you. It belongs to the bank.
It then went to financial institutions.
There's blood in the streets, and no one knows when the bleeding stops.
It then became state debt. It's now being pushed onto the people. But people are not in a position very frequently to bear that, so it's now moving back to financial institutions in some instances. Marx is, I think, very good at giving us a sense of how this moves around. And as it moves around, of course, it engages in a process of destruction.
On the far end of the global trail of the tsunami of fictitious capital in search of return is India, one of the world's largest emerging markets.
The term emerging markets emerges in the late 1980s, early 90s as well. And it's actually coined by people at the World Bank and the IMF in order to describe those economies which are going to be growing very rapidly. Now, why are they so concerned about growth? Not just because they believe that growth will address poverty, but they are interested above all in the quantitative measure of growth. What's the reason for that? If you examine deep enough, you find that if the real economy, instead of 5% per annum, let's say GDP in these areas is growing at 8 or 9%, the returns to financial investors in financial markets actually grow by orders of magnitude greater. So India in 2009 was third most lucrative stock market. The Bombay Stock Exchange was actually yielding annual returns of, on average, about 48%, which is remarkable. So what you actually notice is that India has become an outpost of global finance, of global finance capital.
Finance capital, which Marx called fictitious, is said to have lifted around 200 million people up to the middle class, but left behind an estimated 800 million more, surviving on $1 a day.
Je pense que le monde dans lequel on est en ce début du XXIe siècle ressemble beaucoup au monde qu'observe Marx au XIXe siècle. Il y a un vrai souci par rapport aux inégalités de son temps dont les économistes d'aujourd'hui feraient bien de s'inspirer. C'est-à-dire que ce qui alimente quand même l'inquiétude marxiste et plus généralement les mouvements communistes et socialistes qui se développent dans la deuxième partie du 19e siècle, c'est la très grande stagnation salariale.
Stagnation so severe that in the United States, for example, a CEO was making 20 times more than his employees in the 1950s. In 2000, his salary ballooned to 120 times. And in 2013, it almost doubled again to 204.
This is CNN Breaking News.
It was a Monday morning like none other in the 158-year history of financial giant Lehman Brothers. The company went bankrupt.
If capitalism is not on its deathbed, as Marx predicted, then what could be an alternative theory to explain the 2008 financial crisis and its aftermath?
We recognize that the very nature of globalization, which creates ever higher standards of living, also is a process which we call creative destruction. The problem with creative destruction is that it is destruction.
Creative destruction was a term coined by the early 20th century economist Joseph Schumpeter.
Schumpeter's key idea of creative destruction was the idea that capitalism is constantly revolutionizing itself from within. He called it a process of industrial mutation, where there's incessant change, destroying the old, bringing in the new. And the agent of this change, the person who carried this change out, is the entrepreneur.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
So the basic idea of creative destruction is that there's a new product, that's the creative side, or a new method of producing, and that's all to the good, but there's also the destruction side, which is that it wipes out some earlier method or product, and there's a loss there. There's a social loss, there's a human loss. Schumpeter didn't pay quite as much attention to the loss side as to the creative side.
Today we celebrate the first glorious anniversary of the Information Purification.
That wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 26th annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 5th through March 5th. Most of the films will screen at Portland Community College Cascade Campus, and two films will show at the Hollywood Theater. The five-week-long festival of feature and documentary films come from all over the African continent and include Thursday evening documentary screenings, Family Film Day, and Women Filmmakers Week, held during the first week of March in celebration of Women's History Month. Again, that's 26th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, playing Thursday.